Welcome to the Holiness Today podcast. On today's episode, listen to H. Ray Dunning give two brief lectures, the first on Augustine and the second on Thomas Aquinas.
If one thinks of the history of Christian thought as a mountain range, he should envision several isolated peaks towering above the rest. There are certain individuals which stand head and shoulders above their peers, and their work is so outstanding that we refer to them as classical theologians. What makes the difference between them and others? The difference that earns them the designation great. We probably cannot identify all of the reasons. Doubtless we could point to their massive intellect given to the service of Christ. Or we might even find that a confluence of historical forces created a particularly propitious situation for a man to emerge at that particular time. But I think one of the major reasons is that they were able to bring the Christian faith to a significantly new level of understanding in relation to the problems of their times. While the average intellect may only be repeating traditional views, such men make a creative breakthrough and formulate a theological understanding which moves the theological enterprise forward in a major way. This is not to say that they are above criticism. Pioneers usually have their work brought to a higher level of sophistication. But that refining work could not be done had not the pioneer penetrated the previously existing boundaries. One of these great theological pioneers was Saint Augustine, or Augustine if you prefer. The thrilling story of his early life of waywardness, climaxing with a striking conversion, is reported in his Confessions, one of the greatest spiritual autobiographies of all time. And it is filled with profound theological insights. It abounds with quotable comments, such as his opening thesis that Thou hast made us for Thyself, O Lord, and our souls are restless till they rest in Thee. Augustine lived at a crisis time in history. The classical world was crumbling to an end as the Roman Empire rapidly deteriorated from within and tottered by invasions from without. Thus he stands at a watershed point in history between the classical and medieval worlds. It is commonly said that he was the last great classical figure and the first great medieval man. The weakening of Rome brought accusations against the Christian church. The Christians, declared the Romans, are the cause of our problem because they refuse to worship the Roman gods. Augustine sprang to the defense of the church, and in answer to these charges produced another of his great works, perhaps his greatest, The City of God. This work is basically a philosophy or theology of history, in which he develops the thesis that the history of the world is the scene of the parallel development of two cities, the city of Earth, of which Rome is the signal example, and the City of God, of which the Catholic Church is the embodiment. These two cities have existed side by side from the beginning, and there has always been tension between them. Both of these points are illustrated by the careers of Cain and Abel. The City of Earth has within it the seeds of its own dissolution, while the City of God is destined for eternal glory. He traces the course of these two cities throughout the Bible to the final destiny of each, as recorded in the twofold ending of the book of Revelation. Incidentally, this interpretation became an influential pattern of biblical interpretation from then until now. Certain segments of Exploring the Old Testament, with which you may be familiar, simply reproduces Augustine's way of interpreting the biblical story. On the basis of this analysis, Augustine counters the Roman accusations. Rome is not falling because the Christians refuse to acknowledge Roman deities, but rather it is because Rome is the embodiment of the city of earth, which by its very nature is destined for temporary existence. In his descriptions of these two cities, there comes to expression one of his most valuable insights. He suggests that the cities are ultimately distinguished by the object they love. Those who are citizens of the city of earth are so because of a love of self, while citizens of the city of God are so because of a love of God. The essence of sin in these terms becomes loving something other than God, or something less than God, which is the same thing. The most typical example of such perverted love is self-love, to which Augustine gives the term pride. Thus, pride enters the Christian theological vocabulary as one of the synonyms for sin. But even worse is when one sets his affections on things. Here we encounter one of his most quotable aphorisms. "We ought to love God and use things," he says, "but instead we love things and use God." In this classical explanation of sin, Augustine touches hands with the Wesleyan movement. John Wesley, like Augustine, saw sin in terms of perverted love and conversely proclaimed the possibility of Christian perfection in terms of love. However, Augustine himself was quite far from being a Wesleyan. Perhaps we need to note a significant departure from our tradition at this point. While men are divided into two cities in terms of love, and while Augustine does say that what one loves is the result of an act of will, the bottom line for him is that this act of will is the result of the predestinating activity of God. Augustine is the first to spell out a deterministic view of predestination, and that is because of the way he developed his doctrine of original sin and his view of grace. Because of his morbid view on sex, originating from his own experience, he taught that original sin was perpetuated through the sex act by which conception occurred. Thus, all men born through the natural process were infected to the degree that it was impossible not to sin. In fact, all men are born guilty of Adam's sin. Except for this untenable explanation of how sin is transmitted, the Wesleyan would agree to the universality of sin, of which the doctrine of original sin is the explanation. He would also agree with Augustine, as against Pelagius, that men were unable to will the good or come to God on their own initiative. The only way one can be saved is through grace, which is the activating agent of the human will. Where the two paths diverge is not in the meaning of grace as a healing and enabling power, but in the extent of its efficacy. For Augustine, given his presuppositions, the only way he could find to explain why some men become a part of the city of God and love God, while others remain a part of the city of earth dominated by love of self, was that God's grace was selective based on divine predestination. Thus, when we encounter this teaching, we should most properly designate it as Augustinian, even though it is most popularly attached to the name of John Calvin. One of the most significant theological achievements which Augustine accomplished was to create a synthesis between Christian thought and Neoplatonic philosophy as the representative of classical learning in his day. Thus, he is sometimes called the first Christian philosopher. Even though this was an important accomplishment, its most instructive meaning for us is probably in the fact that he was never able to really pull it off. Throughout his writings, one senses an uneasy tension between Hellenistic thought and biblical faith. This is in large part because the views of God characteristic of these two intellectual worlds move in different directions. When Augustine talked about God in Hellenistic terms, he found it difficult to bring him into living contact with history. We also tend to conceptualize God in Greek thought forms. And so this makes it difficult for us to adequately deal with the dynamic God seen in the pages of the Bible. Augustine is a multifaceted person. He is quoted by Catholics as an authoritative father. He is also quoted by Protestants in the same way. I suppose it is possible to cite him on both sides of many questions. Remember, he was breaking new ground, and his contributions to the ongoing theological enterprise of the Church is beyond estimation. Someone has rightly observed that no one can do theology today without taking account of the work of St. Augustine. One of the most interesting things about him to me is that near the end of his life, he published a work called The Retractions. In it, he took back many of the things he had said with which he no longer agreed. That is the sign of a great, growing, creative mind. I've already started mine. How about you? When I am tempted to become discouraged with the dullness of my students, I need to remember the tall, hulking student in the Middle Ages who was so unresponsive and unpromising that his fellow students nicknamed him the Dumb Ox. His problem was not really lack of ability, but an overplus of bashfulness. His wise and perceptive schoolmaster, Albertus Magnus, recognized the potential lurking beneath the lackluster exterior and uttered a famous prophecy. "You call him a dumb ox," he said. "I tell you, this dumb ox shall bellow so loud that his bellowings will fill the world." His words were truly prophetic, and Thomas Aquinas became the most influential voice in Catholic theology, not only in those years, but probably down to the present. The system of theology he worked out was a masterful example of scholasticism at its best, and formulated in carefully articulated articles the official, in quotes, position of the Catholic Church. He did it in a relatively short time, since his lifespan covered only 49 years, from 1225 to 1274. From being dubbed the Dumb Ox as a student, he became known as the Angelic Doctor. Thomas lived in a day when the Christian faith was being threatened by a new system of thought which appeared to be in conflict with it, Aristotelian philosophy. The otherworldly philosophy of Plato had dominated Christian philosophy throughout the history of Christian thought up to this time. One reason for this was that the works of Aristotle were not readily available to the Western world, and Plato's thought seemed particularly congenial to the Christian faith. But when Aristotle's writings, which had been preserved in Arabian universities, began to reappear in Western culture, it created considerable concern since it was far more secular than Plato's thought. It was the notable achievement of Thomas Aquinas to work out a synthesis between Christian theology and this re-emerging system of philosophy. In doing so, he was both following the lead of his great teacher, Albert, and going against popular opinion. That is one of the fascinating quirks of history, that the work of Thomas was seen as rank liberalism in his day, but now it is the epitome of conservatism, being in fact quite congenial to contemporary fundamentalism. After all, liberalism is a term we usually reserve for views different from our own. The rapprochement which Thomas effected between these two great edifices of thought is usually called the medieval synthesis, and had a number of aspects to it. Perhaps the most encompassing way of speaking of it is as a synthesis between nature and grace. One can visualize the way Thomas worked out the relationship by thinking of a two-story building. The bottom story is nature, while the second floor is grace. Unlike Augustine, He felt that the natural realm was good, but incomplete. It needed only to be supplemented by adding the second story, or grace. We can illustrate this by describing briefly the way he conceptualized the relation between faith and reason. Truth is one. There is no conflict between truths of religion and truths of philosophy, but they are apprehended differently. There are many truths which can be grasped by reason. Even some truths given by revelation may be apprehended by the rational person if he has a trained intellect. However, the whole field of truth is not accessible to reason, but its findings have to be supplemented by revelation. In other words, the first floor of the building of truth can be thoroughly explored by reason, and Aristotle has done this quite adequately in his systematic philosophy, either actually or potentially. To say it differently, reason is good and adequate as far as it goes, but it simply does not go far enough. It bumps its head against the ceiling, and so must be aided in its quest for truth by God adding to man's knowledge those theological truths which transcend his natural knowledge. For instance, Thomas believed that it was possible for reason to demonstrate rationally the existence of God. Consequently, using Aristotle's philosophical categories largely, he set forth five arguments for God's existence. These are mainly variations of the so-called cosmological argument for God's existence. That means reasoning from the fact of the existence of the world to the cause of its existence, namely God. However, even though philosophy may prove that God exists, it cannot discover what God is like. That truth must be given by revelation. At this point, modern theology almost unanimously diverges from Thomas. Since the philosophical work of David Hume and Immanuel Kant, it is recognized that human reason is too finite to rationally demonstrate as coercive proof the reality of the infinite. You can only prove the existence of a finite object, and even that only provisionally. In this sense, modern theology has moved back to Augustine, ascribing far more to revelation than Thomas thought necessary. If you will scrutinize a number of contemporary systematic theologies, you will doubtless not find a single one which begins by using arguments for God's existence as a basis for doing theology. They will all begin with the phenomenon of revelation. One of the most fascinating ways in which Thomas applied his synthesis of nature and grace was in relation to the Christian life. Man, he said, has two ends, that is, purpose goals in life, a natural end and a supernatural end. He may achieve his natural end or good and thus find fulfillment by following the ethical guidance of Aristotle. Thus, the natural life is not evil, as over against grace, but good. It is simply incomplete so far as leading to man's total fulfillment, since he has a supernatural end. Here, revelation is necessary to give man guidance in achieving this level of fulfillment. The moral virtues, as developed by Aristotle in his Ethics, correspond to the natural aspect of life, while the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love correspond to the supernatural life. This twofold view of man's destiny becomes the theoretical basis for a double-level interpretation of the Christian life. Since the natural life is good, though insufficient, it is not to be condemned. The theological virtues in this life is beyond the average person. Only those select few who can give full time to their pursuit may actualize these in their own life here and now. You can readily see how this provides justification for the monastic ideal which was so prevalent during the Middle Ages. One of my university professors used to like to refer to what he called a poor man's Thomism, which he observed in many Protestant churches, where a double standard for laymen and clergymen prevailed. On the assumption that the clergy were in a more exalted position than the laymen, strictures were laid on them from which the average church member was exempt. Needless to say, Martin Luther in the Protestant Reformation rejected such a double standard, insisting that all men share the same high calling to sainthood, with no distinction between minister and layman in his ethical life. For reasons which we cannot explore here, Thomas became the quasi-official philosopher and theologian of the Catholic Church. In this role, there are many of his teachings which Protestants would reject. But in his view of the Christian life, it is amazing how close he is to Wesleyanism. It is his emphasis on the central place of sanctification as a lifelong process in the Christian life that partly gave rise to George Croft Sell's classic characterization of John Wesley's thought as a unique synthesis of the Catholic ethic of law with the Protestant ethic of grace.
Thank you for listening to the Holiness Today podcast. If you enjoyed this production and wish to hear more, visit holinesstoday.org/podcast or find us on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts.